Welcome to City Talks, a monthly podcast looking at the big issues facing UK cities and the latest thinking on urban policy. I'm your host, Andrew Carter, from the think tank Centre for Cities. I hope you enjoy the episode. Welcome to the January edition of City Talks. This edition is a special one in that it was recorded at the launch of Cities Outlook 2018. This year's Cities Outlook focused on how automation and globalisation will affect jobs in British cities over the next decade or so. And the report found that whilst automation and globalisation will boost jobs in British cities over the coming decades, there's a worry that this will also deepen the economic and political divisions across the country. In particular, the report found that cities in the North and Midlands, places like Stoke, Sunderland, Mansfield and Wakefield, are particularly exposed to potential job losses because of automation and globalisation. In these sorts of cities, one in four jobs may well be displaced by 2030. When we compare that to southern cities such as London, Cambridge, Oxford and Reading, that number is one in eight. So quite a significant difference between what's going on in terms of displacement in our northern and midland cities compared to those cities in the greater southeast. The second point from the report is that whilst globalisation and automation will bring jobs to all cities, it's in our northern and midland cities, though they are most exposed, the growth that they will see is more likely to be in lower skilled jobs, where the growth in southern cities will be in particularly higher skilled jobs, which reflects the strength of their economies as we see them today. So while we know that automation and globalisation will bring opportunities, we also recognise that some places could lose out and that we need to take action now to ensure that people and places across the country can share in the benefits that they will bring. In particular, I think this means reforming the education system to give young people the cognitive and interpersonal skills they need to thrive in the future, and indeed improving school standards across the country, especially in places where jobs are most at risk. It also means we need a much greater level of investment and focus on lifelong learning and technical education, adult education more generally, to help adults adapt to the changing labour market. And we need better support to those that will lose their jobs in order that they stay, they're able to access skills, training and education more generally to make sure that they're not left on the sidelines. Finally, I think the report also shows that in an increasingly divided country, whether we think about politically or economically, it's increasingly clear that the one-size-fits-all approach from central government is not up to the task of addressing the very different issues that we see in different places across the country. The needs and opportunities in Blackburn are very obviously different from those in Bristol or in Brighton. And the challenges ahead mean that government needs to give much more power and resources to cities so they can tackle the issues that automation and globalisation will present over the next decade or so. To discuss the findings and their implications of Cities Outlook, I was joined at the launch by Marvin Rees, Mayor of Bristol, Gemma Tetlow, economic correspondent at the FT, and Naomi Clymer, Engineer and Commissioner on the Future of Work Independent Commission and past President of the Institution of Engineering and Technology. And I started by asking Gemma her perspective from a national perspective as to whether she was optimistic or pessimistic in relation to robots and automation, whether this would ultimately be good for the country, and also how she felt that the government was responding or thinking about addressing the issues that automation will bring and what more might be done.
So if you look at the UK population as a whole, you can look at this for kind of mixed feelings about automation and robots. It's quite an interesting Eurobarometer poll last year that found about 60% of people in the UK think that robots and automation offer some positive benefits, they're positive about them. And that's about the same as the average you see across the EU. British workers actually, less than other European workers, they're not so worried about robots taking their jobs. They think they do things that couldn't be automated, couldn't be robotised. So in a sense, there's a bit of a positivity in the UK around that. On the other hand, the feeling of the British public overall is that actually robots and AI will destroy more jobs than it's going to create over the next few years. So there is certainly some nervousness there. In terms of government policy, I think we're clearly seeing the government make make many of the right noises around the future of jobs, the future of automation. The industrial strategy last year clearly pointed to some of the issues. It had some ambitious statements about Britain being at the forefront of AI and big data technologies. But I have some sort of skepticism or some questions about how much that's going to play out in terms of really big changes. Some of the issues that were pointed to around lack of skills and low productivity in the UK have been around for many years. The question has to be, why are these sets of policies going to be any different from the many that have come before them? And certainly there's a sense that in further education policies in the UK, there's been successive tinkering that's never really come up with a comprehensive set of policies that develop those technical non-higher education skills that the economy needs. There's also a lack of new money put behind many of the policies in the industrial strategy. There was an ambition to get more private money in, but there's clearly a constraint on how much public money there is available to put behind any of these initiatives. One thing that stood out for me actually in the Centre for Cities report today is that half of the jobs that was going to be future growth were in things that are publicly funded activities, presumably around health and care. And at the moment, we clearly don't have a long-term funding strategy for those areas. The NHS is getting money thrown at it in a very piecemeal fashion. The election showed that we don't have a long-term agreement on how we're going to fund care. So that, I think, is an interesting area. And the elephant in the room, as you said, has to be Brexit here. I think for businesses, there's a difficulty in committing to new investments and new business strategies when you don't know what the UK's trading environment is going to be in the future. And for government, it's clearly taking up a huge amount of bandwidth within the civil services among ministers that could otherwise be spent on trying to deal with some of these domestic areas. So take some of the right noises, some ambition, but concerns about how much this is really going to change.
Great. Well, we'll come back and pick up some of those issues. Marvin, in a sense, optimistic, pessimistic, and more particularly, I suppose, from a city leadership perspective. How do we respond? Where do we go?
Well, I'm not an optimist. I'm a person of hope. and the level of hope I've got depends on where we're looking for solutions. So I'd say, the need to change the way we do education so people have flexibility of thought, that we need to introduce lifelong learning and have the safety net. I'm absolutely all on board with that. But I think, for me, the elephant in the room is, one is Brexit, the other is that I think national governments can't deliver in the way the world is today. They went from climate change to migration to democratic legitimacy to inequality. The building everything around the national government structure is busted. And what we need to start doing is looking at city leadership and networks of city leadership. So we really need to start pushing into that city sovereignty. So the flexibility of thought, the ability to move, the immediacy of that leadership and governance to the population is where we are going to open up resources for new kinds of answers and solutions. But a number of things that I just thought along with this as well. One is, it does talk about inequalities between cities, but you need to talk about inequalities within cities. So Bristol is a wealthy city, but we've got six areas in the city in the top 1% most deprived in England. We've got 45 in the top 45%. So actually, often people talk about it well, but for some people, in Bristol South, it's got among the lowest numbers of people, it might be the lowest number of people going on to higher education. So these are the people that are likely to be left behind, despite the fact they have two world-class universities, Wallace and Gromit, thriving tech sector and all that type of stuff. I think we do also, in the name of that city governance, we really need to drive into whole place leadership at a local level. As well as national governments, I think, reaching the end of some of their useful, they are actually very important, but they can't do everything. Local government, we need to move beyond the conversation of local government to local governance. And by that, I mean what people receive from place is not just the result of decisions made in City Hall, it's the NHS, criminal justice system, private sector. And what we need to do is find a way of harnessing that collective impact, that collective sovereignty, rather than just disproportionately laying the burden of responsibility on any single institution. So for me, I start with that. We need to shape the economy on purpose so that it's inclusive. And I don't know if it was fair, but I sensed that there was a kind of, in the report, that there was a kind of, we'll be okay, we've been here before. And we've got through it, and I suppose in that sense I'm not confident in that. I think that we have seen automation before, and what it meant was lots of people ended up in prison. If you look at the experience of African Americans, right? We are now superfluous to the requirements of the economy. We got a place for you to go.
Yep.
It's a federal justice system, you know, and you work for cheap labour there. So we, you know, and actually massive population of social media, the price of getting this wrong, I think, is potentially much higher today than it was 100 years
ago. No, you make a great point. We have in the report, without going into the detail in a sense, you know, one of the things that we did through the 70s and 80s and certainly is that we parked a lot of people, for example, on incapacity benefit, and essentially left them there for a long period of their, you know, what so-called working out, and we cannot do that. We cannot do that again in terms of automation. So you know, I think there are challenges, which is why we were very keen to highlight the distributional effects as well as the aggregate. Because if you always talk at the aggregate, you miss all the nuances. But it's very important to come back to those sorts of things. Naomi, from a tech engineering industry perspective, automation, optimistic, pessimistic, hopeful, unhopeful?
Yeah, I'm a chronic optimist about this. Good. And I do totally acknowledge the kind of challenges and the concerns. I think the potential for horrendous inequality is absolutely there. So I do worry about it, but it feels like raw opportunity to me. And actually, one of the things I liked about this report, which is looking at things kind of regionally and locally, is I do think that the picture looks different depending on where you look, and actually that some of the solutions will be quite different depending on where you are. But the potential to generate meaningful work in all sorts of places that aren't in the hub of London or these big cities, I think the potential to do that with the kinds of work that we might have in the future is really strong. So I think there's a major opportunity. From an industrial point of view, I think Gemma mentioned that investment, a lot of companies are worried about investment, but certainly the commission that I sat on, we felt that investing in automation and new technology is really important. It's part of the productivity puzzle. But actually what's interesting about that is it has to kind of go hand in hand with skills. A company can invest in the tech, and if they can't get the right kind of people, or if they can't reskill their existing team, then they've got problems. But I've seen wonderful best practice examples of companies that have invested in automation with some local incentives to help them do that. And then they've used the increase in productivity to reskill their staff and increase their production, so the business is better off, they've kept everyone employed, they've reskilled them or upskilled them. And so that's worked really nicely. But I also already see some really bad examples where the kind of jobs that are created are just soul-destroyingly awful. And so the Commission certainly thinks that having good work is important. Whether there's enough jobs or not is one thing, but having decent quality work that is meaningful and gives you a sense of purpose feels really important. And I do think that there are things that we can do about that, both locally and nationally, to think about making sure that people have work that is meaningful and well rewarded. And so I liked in the report that it says this isn't about kind of cities competing with each other, but I also love the idea. You look at somewhere like Grimsby, for example. I was reading about them in the paper the other day, and it's a town that's been built up on the fishing industry. It's not there anymore. It looks pretty dire there, but actually they've got this kind of renewable energy opportunity, so that may work for Grimsby if they get the skills piece right at the same time, but for another city the opportunity may be different. I was also reading the other day that that one of the mass blue-collar jobs of the future may be programming. And I reflected on that, and I think that sounds very sensible, and that's the kind of thing you can do in all sorts of places as long as you've got a decent infrastructure. And again, that's an opportunity for cities in different parts of the country to think about the skills that they need locally. There's a lot said both in the industrial strategy and at Davos last week about artificial intelligence being something that the UK could do well, and I know there's been a bit of cynicism around that, but the fact is, you know, DeepMind, the kind of biggest AI company that's been bought by Google, that's come out of the UK. We are good at this stuff. And so the idea that we should be teaching AI in schools, not just for the future engineers, but actually so people understand what it's about, they know about the ethics, they can think about those things. Some of that is national curriculum, but some of it is about regions and localities thinking about what sorts of skills are going to work in that area. So I'm quite optimistic about it, but inequality, you know, sits heavily across all of it, and I do think we have to guard against that, and I think that is a mixture of some national policy, but an awful lot, I support the idea that an awful lot of this could be done regionally and locally. And I'd like to see some more pilots and experiments. I think we should, you know, take on some of the areas that are really struggling and try some stuff to see what we can generate.
Yeah, excellent. Gemma, you said several things, but you said you're not convinced that the government is serious. What would convince you that they were serious? Well, I mean, what would they need to do in terms of, you know, whether it's an investment profile or, you know, a dedication towards addressing an issue or X or Y, beyond the words, you know, what would give you heart and hope that they were serious? And you might see the dial shift slightly.
I think on some things it's a case of putting in place a set of policies and then not feeling the need to go back and tinker with them. Sorry, that's a horrible what's happened in the past, but nothing's been allowed to bed in long enough. I think they're serious, so put things in place. On the sort of devolution to local areas, I think it's a case they've really got to give local areas some power and let them go off and try something new and not try and bring that in. In some areas, perhaps a bit more serious money going behind it. I mean, it's great that they've got the targets to increase research and development spending, but a lot of that is about trying to get private money in, which is fantastic, but we need to both see that happen and have the government seriously putting some money in that area as well.
And Naomi, you know, you talked about, you see lots of examples, great examples of, you know, firms particularly working with us to do great things. Part of the challenge is how we get more firms doing that, rather than just always having, you know, the world-class exception, really. What's your thinking on that? How do we get more firms to be thinking about investing in their products, in their workforce, in their, you know, the training, which we've seen has been declining for quite some time?
Yeah, no, and I think for some of the bigger companies, some of that is just about sharing best practice and making sure that it's visible and others get the idea. But I do think there's a part that both government and cities can play with smaller and medium-sized companies, where the skills piece of the equation is so, so important that actually you can imagine a kind of a local university working with a local industry and some support from regional authorities to look at how they can have a kind of 10, 20 year plan of how they're going to develop in that area. And so I think part of why it's a bit hard is it needs quite a collaborative effort, certainly between educators, some form of government and the industry. And the bigger companies, in theory, are big enough to do it on their own, but if you're small or medium-sized, you need help. And I do think the future, that the giant corporations, there'll be fewer of them. And we've got a few giants for infrastructure, but actually the opportunity to run a smaller or medium-sized company and to be innovative, given the way that tech is going, is definitely there. So I actually think the balance between big companies and small and medium companies will shift. But that will mean that there needs to be a bit more collaboration between the authorities and
the
companies.
Marvin, you talk about, which I completely agree with, in the sense that leadership at the city level and response at the city level is increasingly required in order to deal with some of the issues that this report and other reports throw up. How do we take the city leadership agenda, you know, to the next scale, to the next level? What needs to happen? National government, you know, at the local level?
Well, it's going to have to be both. I think it's the great irony of Brexit, actually, that as things become more chaotic, I think national government will have a tighter grip on stopping in decision making. It's my suspicion. I may be proved to be wrong. But as they want to be much more intentional about, you know, not, as the things become more uncertain, I can imagine national policymakers and leaders will want more control over what goes on. So the big irony would be that the signal to the system will be more control in Westminster. But what are we doing at the city level? In the core cities, we're going off to meet Michel Barnier ourselves, for example. So cities are beginning to step into that space, whether they have the mandate to do so or not. In October in Bristol, we're hosting the Global Parliament of Mayors. So we'll have 80 to 100 mayors from all over the world coming together in Bristol for 3 days, and we're all talking about how we begin to work as international networks of cities, irrespective of what our national governments are doing. How do we work together around some of those key issues that we're facing? So I think it's going to be a bit of most, you know, there's going to be some permission granted, but there's going to be some ground taken, and then we'll see how that begins to play itself out.
Gemma, why are we so bad on technical education and adult education in the workforce compared to other places? I mean, what is it about, I mean, you know, we say we need more of that. This has been an ongoing, we need more of added education, more technical education, particularly parity between the classic university route and the vocational route. And yet, we don't seem to make much progress on that. Is that fair? I mean, why are we so bad? What can we do about that?
I mean, that's a very good question. And I don't think it's just, it's not just that sort of higher level technical education that we get wrong at the end of the process. And if you look at just basic numeracy and literacy skills of the UK population, the UK stands out as being, I think, the only advanced economy where younger adults these days have no better skills than older adults do. So something, other countries have managed to have that generation on generation improvement basic skills, which the UK seems to have failed to achieve in the with the education system that we've had. One element seems to, if you talk to people involved in further education, seems to be just we've had the mishmash of policies and different initiatives, and local areas have tried to piece together the bits of money available for one initiative or another to come up with some kind of policies. So it seems to be a bit of a mishmash, perhaps some rationalisation.
Is that fair? I mean, how do you, from an industry point of view, our approach to this sort of stuff, not good enough? Not good enough for a long time, or?
No, I think the constant tinkering is definitely unhelpful. I almost think the sort of national attitude, the culture we have around skills and learning seems to be a bit off. And in terms of lifelong learning, I mean, I think lifelong learning is essential. Anyone starting out working today is going to have to pivot and learn some new skills and will have several different careers during their lifetime, and they need to have access to lifelong learning. But actually, one of the issues you hit when you offer that to people is that not everyone wants it, not everyone wants to learn something new, they just want their old job. And again, that almost feels like a cultural thing. But I lived in California for a while, so I was surrounded by kind of optimism and can-do, and it's really hit me coming back to the UK how we do tend to be a bit sort of downbeat about some of this stuff. So I actually think there's a kind of weird national culture thing where we possibly need to find a way to have a different attitude about learning and lifelong learning as something that everyone should be excited about and embracing. But I don't underestimate how hard that will be. But we need that across the board throughout life, that people need to be ready to learn and then have access to it. Perhaps get the curriculum right. It's quite difficult with AI. There's a lot of discussion about what you should teach people in schools. You know, we still obsess over getting handwriting. Who handwrites? I sign things. I almost never handwrite. And things like drilling yourself full of knowledge when you could look it up on Google in 2 minutes. You know, how much of this stuff should we still be teaching in schools? It sort of needs a radical rethink. But I'm not suggesting yet another tinker, because that probably wouldn't help either. But there's some pretty big stuff that needs to happen here.
Yeah. My culture of learning, and the value in it, intrinsic value in it. How do we do that? What's your lesson for Britain? I mean, before becoming a politician, you did work in social work and that sort of area, engaging with those that hadn't had necessarily the best educational experiences. How do we draw them back in, or how do we encourage more learning amongst a broader range of our communities?
Oh, that's a big question.
Yeah, asks the biggest questions.
Yeah. How do you develop that culture? I suppose there is a warning. There's one thing I just want to say. Bristol offers a national picture, a national warning, because we are evidently recently named the UK's number one smart city. We have all these brands about our tech, and as I said, we have these inequalities, ferocious education inequalities, health expectancy inequalities, healthy life years inequalities in the city, and we hold that together. So we are on the forefront of taking advantage of much of this new kind of economy. And yet, tens of thousands of people in the city are left behind. And that is the challenge we have to take on. So it's not easy, even though I advocate more city sovereignty and space to move. Restricted in taking action because of the national policy, but it's a challenge. But I mean, in terms of getting that culture of learning, if I was to draw my own experience and that of my friends, I went to a school where I think about five of us went to university for my year. The big difference between me and some of my friends was I developed a sense of hope that there was something I could do, and that there was space in the economy, there was a viable alternative for me to the lifestyle that many of my friends were in. I think generations of people in my city have just received a message from their grandparents and their parents that there is no space in the economy for them.
and then in that sense give up and not see education as a pathway to building the future.
Yeah. I just wanted to get the panel's initial reflections on something that I've been debating internally with colleagues around universal basic income. Yeah. For it, against it, good idea, terrible idea, and kind of responding to, you know, the downsides of automation, jobs are disappearing, you know, universal basic income is the way to go forward. Lots of interest in lots of different circles on the left and indeed on the right in terms of this sort of agenda. But give me a thought on that.
I think possibly in a world where all jobs are done by robots and no one needs to work at all, I can see an argument for it. In the current world, I'm not very pro-universal basic income. I think at the end of the day, we want to give more money to people who are, for one reason or another, unable to work, whether through age, disability. And I think at the end of the day, it will just break down and become another welfare policy, even if you try to get it.
Okay. Naomi, for or against? Lots of people in the tech industry seem to be in favour of it, at least as I read the literature.
Well, I think it's really important to look after the people who are left behind, and so somehow we need to do that. One of the things we found on the commission when we looked at work is that work is so much more than just money. It's a kind of sense of purpose, it's a sense of value, so that at least at the moment, the way that people view work is a lot more than just money. So one of the concerns about just giving people money is that you're missing a whole bunch of other things that people get. So I would personally rather be very proactive about creating enough good jobs for everyone, but nonetheless, you absolutely need to have some kind of safety net.
Well, where do you stand on the UBI debate?
I think people, we had a discussion here so recently, I think people push it, so it's a radical policy. I think it'd be much more radical to make sure the economy works for people rather than for the economy. I think it's a lazy response. We'll run the economy, we'll see what pops out, and if you end up falling out of the other end, there's no space for you, we'll give you some money to keep you alive. I find it lazy.
Thank you for listening to this episode of City Talks, brought to you by Centre for Cities. You can find us on iTunes and Stitcher by searching Centre for Cities. Please rate, review and subscribe if you liked what you heard. You can also follow the Centre on Twitter at Centre for Cities, or like us on Facebook and LinkedIn for the latest updates on what the Centre is up to. If you have any comments on the episode or suggestions for topics we should cover in the future, we'd love to hear from you. Do tweet us or send an email to info@centreforcities.org. The music was from Palace Fires by Johnny Foreigner. Used with permission, and all rights are reserved.